Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we have Dr. Norm Clement, head of Pronto Pharmacy, and an individual who has made his voice loud and clear throughout social media and internet platform, advocating for healthcare professionals who have been wrongfully treated by the federal government, particularly the DEA. His voice comes through lived experiences, and his voice is one that resonates and inspires many to join in this call to speak up and promote both patient rights and healthcare professional rights. Join me in welcoming Dr. Norm Clement. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here today with you guys. I don't think today, if I can call you that, we're just happy to be on your platform here to talk about this form of judicial injustice that takes place in America and corruption. It affects the health care of most of us in this country, how we realize, how many of us don't realize how our health care is being undermined by so-called authorities or malicious prosecution.
Certainly, certainly. Now, before we delve into the topics, can you go a little bit into your background story? Tell us a little bit about what happened to you and how you are giving voice to your experience and to others through your platform, You're Within the Norms.
Yeah. Well, I'm a pharmacist and I'm also a dentist. I graduated from Florida A&M University of student pharmacy some time ago, but today. And there I practiced pharmacy for, I think, about 2 years. I graduated in 1981 and I've since gone back and gotten all my requirements for my master's degree on the Academy of General Dentistry at the University of Florida College of Dentistry. In the meantime, I moved to Tampa and I found myself running a pharmacy. Owning a pharmacy, and called Pronto Pharmacy, and we specialized. We were a specialty pharmacy. We specialized in treating people for pain and pain disorders because it was, just simply difficult to compete with big boys who had about everything. But this area of specialty was something that we could do quite well and make a good living from, and also help a lot of people who are simply being mistreated, misaligned, in many cases not being treated at all. And so we set forth because in practicing pharmacy and dentistry, I came to get quite a bit of knowledge about pain and pain medication and how to treat people for pain. Our biggest thing is we treat people with dignity and respect, always with dignity and respect, and let people know that that's what we were there. We were there for them. To help them in their treatment. And so we got to Pronto Pharmacy, and this pharmacy we dispense and we also compound our medications that were made a lot cheaper for people to get services, and made quite a good a good living. And we also follow the rules. We narcotic analgesics are an area where you have to really know when you're in this position. So we knew what we were doing, and our people were highly trained and are highly skilled, and we set about treating very good food.
Nice. And then tell us what happened with the DEA. How did they misconstrue what was an effective pharmaceutical practice that provided unique relief for patients with chronic pain? How did they misconstrue that to be a criminal enterprise?
Well, that's very interesting. In that, at some point in our practice, we got the DEA guy came by and said he was looking into our business. And, I didn't quite. I had heard things that they were paid for. They had a policy or something that you can only travel a certain distance for your to get certain medications. In fact, we heard from many of our patients that they couldn't get their prescription. You know, we'd ask them, why are you in screen? Why are you coming to Tampa, which is maybe 140 miles from home? And they were saying, we couldn't get the medication for a long range, and they stigmatized us and those sort of things. And I said, and are they able to deny them the medication? Of course, I would ask, well, did the pharmacist look at your prescription and, look at your, do some physical examination on you? No. Well, how can he deem you a junkie or something like that? He was very derogatory. I understand people got around, and the doctors would tell us that their patients appeared to be targeted or being mistreated and stigmatized. And so people began to refer patients to us. And, me being a dentist, knew that the main way you build a practice, always treat people with dignity and respect. People come in, and sometimes they're dirt poor, they may be inarticulate in those things. When you treat those people with respect and dignity, yes, ma'am, no way. What's going on? Here they're checking us out. Some of them, they give you any help, but they'll come back to you. And they will send their friends to you. They will send their neighbor. They will refer you. And their doctors will refer people, especially when you're knowledgeable in this area of medicine, which a lot of people think that they can just, slam, bam, take a prescription, fill it, bam, and then charge you a whole slew of money, and bam, you're out the door and you talk to any old kind of way. That's not treat people with, find out what's wrong with them. Find out what makes them happy, what makes them tick. Get into this, communicate with these patients. You'll find out people will come to trust you, and they will, and they rely upon your services because they're not getting those kind of things. They really help them, our staff.
Right. I like that because, you're alluding to something that's critical. Treating patients with respect, treating them as individuals who, regardless of how they may look or where they're coming from, warrant clinical care. Now, it seems
Or how bad they smell.
Or how bad they smell, sure. So what's interesting is that...
People with dignity and respect.
Exactly. What's interesting is that the DEA is looking at certain signs or insinuations and then making judgments on criminality based upon that. The distance somebody has to travel, their physical appearance. Those are markers that may or may not correlate to criminal activity. In most cases, it may not, because it's generally accepted that people do travel certain distances for clinical care, be it at the physician office or going to a certain pharmacy. Why do you think the DEA is taking this seemingly convoluted approach? Some may say that they lack the proper investigational techniques, and some may say that they are using these techniques deliberately to essentially stigmatize certain physicians and pharmacists the same way patients are stigmatized. Can you talk a little bit about your experience directly and how you feel the DEA is misunderstanding what's going on?
The people they have right there are poorly trained. Okay? They don't know anything about it. These are people who actually are, we wrote an article, they're armed with badges and guns and profound stupidity. They don't know anything about the mechanism of action of these medications. In fact, what we do and we determine medically, they look at something and look at it criminally. We say we have a tablet, we we look at a tablet or a liquid or something, they look at it as being something that's illegal. In other words, there's certain code words to look for in the DEA's pattern. You hear the word, first one is opioid. Another one is pillman. Another one is overdose. You know, these words and these phrases are what we call the makeup of professorial propaganda that is used.
Nice.
These positions. You know, if anybody, and once you lock onto these phrases, you begin to realize that these people, again, if people knew what a pill was. I've been a pharmacist 47 years, and I know a lot of physicians, pharmacists, and I can probably count on one hand how many times I've dispensed pills. A pill is a separate dosage form within medicine, just as a capsule and a tablet, or a Trocet, suppository. And the only significance that a pill has in this case is that pill rhymes with mill. So we can then use that to exaggerate that into some sort of criminal activity and talk about pill and mill. The other thing is we oftentimes see in these, and this is getting a little ahead of itself, but we started doing the writing and speaking with the doctors and including myself and including these warrants that are being used, that this person dispensed 480 pills. This person came in and they were on 680 pills of Holy Trinity or something like that, or whatever, using exaggerated terms. That, again, it says nothing, or even in these so-called warrants that they issue, these arrest warrants, you know, we find out that most of them, all of them, we came across, lack probable cause, because when someone says a doctor wrote a prescription for 55,000 tablets, pills of oxycodone, that doesn't say anything. What's wrong with that? You know, you went about the disease, you know, this, first of all, the doctor's license to write these medications, and then most importantly, these warrants and these courts leave out the disease state of the patient. In other words, what are the doctors, what are these physicians treating these medications, using these medications to treat disease states that they're treating these patients for, the pathology that is taking place. And the other interesting, too, if you notice, and it's something I had never, if you think about, that it is physician-centric. In other words, Jim said the doctor. What about the dentist here? You know, who writes medication for a similar.
Yeah, certainly. There's a particular blame game that can go around. I think at the heart of the issue is that there's a complete lack of understanding from the DEA on the medical need for medications. And because they lack that understanding, they tend to simplify the prescription writing of medications into, as you mentioned, Holy Trinity or a certain number of pills. Instead of looking at the benefit of the medications, they're looking at just pills in blank quantities. As both a dentist and a pharmacist, you clearly have a unique understanding on pharmacology. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in trying to educate or convey to the DEA the medical need and the gross lack of understanding from the DEA?
Well, the DEA is the DEA is kind of a criminal enterprise within government. And they're using they're viewing down this watered down or lack of interpretation as a way to criminalize medical procedures and criminalize those who treat these medical procedures so as they can harvest them into jail and fund their agency and stuff. One of the reasons this is happening is that the DEA has failed to control the illicit, the truly illicit narcotic market, that is the heroin, the poppy, and the fentanyl production in in other countries. We're dealing with a geopolitical problem. And so what we have here is that your doctor is an easier enforcement target, because the DEA, and it's been shown clearly in the articles that we write, in yours and in more of an article I can think of, your doctor, your pharmacist is not the source of illegal drugs. But the DEA is in bed and cooperative with the warlords in Afghanistan, the drug cartels throughout South America and around this world. They are in bed with these guys. And we see that they squandered, that the Congress, that early on, gave them $8.6 billion to what they said they were going to eradicate the poppy field and those sort of things. That money has gone missing, or gone lost. So what, and more importantly, when you do the numbers on what the DEA has done, and you see time in many articles, Leo Blavatsky, I'm thinking of, Nastron DeSouza, talking about how they have made the problem, if it was a problem, even much worse than it is, that you see that they have targeted these doctors by using guidelines that are simply unscientific. It makes no sense.
Right. The millimorphine equivalents that really became popular in 2016 when a certain group of physicians and scientists from this organization known as PROP began espousing these claims. Talk a little bit from a pharmacological standpoint how the millimorphine equivalent is not based on any sound clinical principles, and talk about how the guidelines have hurt on an individual level patients with chronic pain.
Well, here's the issue. One cannot equivalize one control medication or any medication with another medication. In fact, when you're making brands or generic, even the DEA tolerates a 20% difference in the mechanism and the results of the tolerance in the results of these medication and their performance when given to a patient. So one comes in and says that I can take oxycodone and I can equivalent it with a morphine dose and call it a morphine milligram equivalent. When this was set out originally, it was based upon class 4 evidence or class 4, I mean, unscientific parameters and those sort of things. How it got moving was that the organization that was pushing this was called PROP, Physicians for the Responsible Use of Opioids. They also had a financial interest in a product made by a company called RG. We call it RGB, Rickettsia, and I don't know keeping it with the B was for. But they had a financial interest in this company that was making Suboxone. And Suboxone was a product that was to replace or use in conjunction or better than morphine in getting folks who had become addicted to illicit heroin and other narcotic medications to maintain them and get them off of this so that we could get them into a normal, bring them back to a normal livelihood where they wouldn't have to be dependent upon going out the street and getting these type of street drugs, getting high with them, overdosing, as they claim, and boom. And so, they had a financial interest in it. So one of the things they did was they went in and decided, well, one of the ways we can build our business model up is by criminalizing, lowering the amount that anyone can get in a controlled medication, knowing that, and essentially what they ended up doing was criminalizing folks who were getting hunger, who suffered from chronic disease states like a sickle cell, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, those kind of things. And we would say that all a person could get was a one-size-fits-all 90 milligrams. Anything above that, we will reduce them down. They knew these people would reduce them down to 90 milligrams. They knew these people would have a hell of a time getting adjusted to these doses, if at all. So these people would then end up on their product, Suboxone. What has all happened was, is some ended up on Suboxone, but many end up killing themselves. And many end up dying. And what had also happened was it began to criminalize doctors that, well, this is not, this is not right. And these doctors began to treat their patients.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they found themselves being raided by the Drug Enforcement Agency. It also provided funding for the Drug Enforcement Agency, and that it provided cover, for the sales job they had been doing overseas in terms of controlling the heroin that was coming in.
I think the failed policies of the DEA are well known. In fact, the Office of Inspector General, the OIG, criticized the DEA for the manner in which they handled the opiate epidemic initially. So I think that it's well known what you are saying, because policy experts both within the government and outside patient advocates like yourself have come to the same conclusion. The question, though, becomes, why do physicians and pharmacists being targeted continue to endure this stigma when it's generally accepted that the DEA is pursuing failed policies that are hurting more than helping patients?
Well, you got to understand what's happening here, Jay. You and I went to some medical, we were good boys. Yeah, we were good kids, you know. The good guys, you know, who followed the rules, you know. You know, oh, man, we were clean, driven, nerds, you know, father, whatever. You know what I'm saying? We don't know anything about, you know, doggone law enforcement. And we weren't breaking and entering and tearing up stuff. Most of us weren't. You know, we were guys, you know, the guys everybody wanted to be like, man, with a shirt and tie on. Talk proper and King English and all that kind of good stuff, you know. And we don't always talk about criminal. You hear it oftentimes. Most of these guys are saying, yeah, I never had any problem with law enforcement until I got my MD degree or my pharmacy degree or my DDS degree. You know, what's all this happening here? I'm doing exactly what I'm saying. So we don't know how to fight. You don't know how to fight. I mean, you I'm telling you, the average crook knows about the rights in court, and they've been a highly paid, highly specialized position in their work. But it's just not our venue. It's not our venue. But our anesthesiologists, they're not into that kind of stuff. We're about treating people, making sure they get the medication. The last thing on our mind is that what we were taught to do in medical school, or pharmacy school, or dental school is criminal. But that's what the DEA has done, and they know that. They know that we don't know anything. In fact, I have a brother, Walter, and I think you encountered him too. I mean, he was the first to bring to my attention. He says, Norm, these warrants are defective. You can't use an administrative warrant to do this kind of stuff. I said, well, what are you talking about? It took me a long time to understand probable cause or what was probable cause. So they're using our ignorance, our kindness, and our gentleness to take advantage of us. And then plus, MD, man, this is supposed to be the degree of all degrees and specialties. You know, these are people who save life and death, cardiovascular surgeons.
So the question becomes, why is the stigma still present? And this is the thing you and I have been grappling with. Why do people still consider what the DEA is doing as legitimate? And one of the things we had mentioned is there's still this notion that those who are targeted by the DEA, quote unquote, must have done something wrong. Quote unquote, there must have been something there. So there's this kind of specter of the unknown that the DEA tends to manipulate and exploit. Those who are on the inside see it clearly, but those who have not been affected seem to still fall for this kind of mirage that the DEA is portraying. Tell me why you feel it still exists and how you've experienced it.
I mean, most of us, most people do not quite understand. Most people resent science and medicine. And we went to medical school, and when we went up, when we were in undergrad, we knew that there were buildings in that university that everyone hated. But we loved them because we love science and math. Most people don't have an understanding of it. They can't understand the procedures we do and how they get done. And so it's easy to stigmatize a doctor by saying the doctor is excessive. And plus, that just being a doctor, don't remember, we got this degree. Man, that's beautiful. Man, to law enforcement, oh, we're a rich target. We're target rich. People with the title, the name, we're property rich, and so they can go in and seize and do anything they want, and we won't fight back. We'll go to lawyers, and our lawyers don't understand what the hell we're talking about, and so the disease state of the patient will never get into the courtroom.
So you think the inability to fight back is the main reason why this propaganda continues?
Jay, there are very few advocates in medicine. They went to medical most of us are quiet guys that are about taking care of people. We're not advocates of rabble rousers, of revolutionaries. You know, we do have the history, and so we don't understand that in this process you have to be an advocate. Advocate means you have to get out there and that you have to fight. That you have to be about determination. You have to be about selling your product. You've got to be about, well, looking militant, looking mean. That's something that's not within our character. But when we do start fighting back, when we do start being able to communicate the science with the lawlessness that is taking place, then we become even more effective. And this is the one thing that I find that so many these doctors that we talk about, and I'm sure you've encountered, are so afraid to speak up. But when those who speak up, and the interesting about this project has been that there are a lot of doctors who are out here that were fighting, but they all seem to have been fighting all by themselves. But they were, it's funny, we all came from these various diverse backgrounds, genders, race, you name it, political beliefs. But yet, here were all these doctors scattered all over the world coming to the same conclusion that the DEA was a criminal enterprise, a criminal organization.
So you feel that our credibility lies in our unity, our ability to share our collective voices and allow our stories to be put into one strong legal argument? The credibility, in your mind, would say, comes from the unified voices of each individual, or do you feel that certain individuals have more power than others?
Certain individuals in all movements have to stand up and then vote for coalesce and come around. A lot of people were just simply scared. But what we did a year with the North, as we began to get this person thought, and we put it together, we published it, and bam, all kind of folks started writing, and hey, this happened to me, this happened to me, or here's a person that was doing the same thing and wasn't aware that one person was gathering statistical data and stuff, but it was a physician. That's not what a physician is normally trained to do, but that person, it kicked in mode, the fight mode kicked in, and we find that the guys who are leading this movement are guys who said, you know, hey, there's an injustice here, and I'm not going to just lay down and tolerate it. Or better yet, the fear of going to prison, the fear of losing your family, and this is after the fear of seeing guys who chose to remain silent and then went to prison or serving life sentences in prison, that's what got a lot of us moving.
So what do you think is a unique skill that you bring? Because clearly the manner in which you speak conveys a lot of passion. You're within the norms. Is very unapologetic in its messaging and very straightforward. It, you can say very much it hits hard in the truest sense of the phrase. Tell us a little bit about your individual contributions and how your manner of speaking and your personality type has given courage and confidence to a lot of people.
Oh,
again, when we say it penetrates deception, the DEA has tried to maintain, DEA and the United States Attorney General's Office maintain that this aura that they're going after these criminal doctors, when in fact they're operating under a false, fraudulent, unscientific method that they're using in supporting the MME and trying to and have codified it into law and then use this to come around and target, as what we call, and persecute prescribing physicians treating people for a disease state. For example, and so what we've done is we've exposed that fraudulent activity upon them, and the DEA were up until then they were bullied because we weren't fighting back. Once I realized that we could put this into right and get and coalesce a group of people who fought the same and think tank, in other words, folks involved in law enforcement, folks involved in surgery, folks who could write, folks who have been grew up in neighborhoods where they were exposed to this type of the drug wars and who did better for themselves. We put all these people together in this think tank, began to put them in doors and in arms, and that's what has made the difference, getting this message out there. And what we have found is that the DEA is exactly that. They're a bunch of bullies. They're bullies. When the minute we confront them, say, hey, you can't support that indictment. You can't support that indictment because your indictment is fraudulent. It lacks probable cause. Or the fact that you use a morphine milligram equivalent standard is fraudulent. Makes that testimony fraudulent. Makes the whole case fraudulent. When we start exposing those type of deceptions that are taking place in the court and so-called expert witnesses that drew conclusions that a doctor, because they were writing for a certain dose level for a patient, was committing or a certain type of medication for a patient was committing a crime, rather without, for one, examining the patient's records, without looking at any radiograph, without looking at any physician progress reports. And you can draw conclusions saying that by looking at this MME dose level of the medication being prescribed, that that's a crime? You know? Come on.
Yeah.
And so when we began to expose that deception, then their cases, a few of their cases started falling apart. In other words, their expert witness were proven to be liars. In fact, it reminded me of something that we had in dentistry at one point. It was called, and you may have heard about this, bite mark evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bite mark evidence meant that a person, he bit on someone, and you can look by the pattern that the impression is left in the person's skin, we can look at that pattern and tie that to the actual occlusal formation in their teeth, and by taking an impression, we can match those occlusal formation, a pattern, with the model that you had there and say that identify that particular person. Turns out that type of thinking, while theoretically it makes sense, it didn't make sense. It didn't work clinically, because who's going to sit? In fact, there were a lot of errors in this thing. So this bite mark evidence fell into disfavor, but it continued to be used by courtrooms because the people who had generated this bite mark evidence were too far into it to turn around, and even though they knew it was a lie. In fact, there was one gentleman that was on death row. I think he had 11 trials in Arizona. And the people who questioned this one dentist who supported bite mark evidence, and I knew the people. You know, really, I knew people who questioned about this bite, saying that this stuff is fraudulent. You know, and his answer was, well, I'm too far into it to turn around now. You know, I might as well keep the lie out. And this is what you have here in me. What you have here in these prosecutors, and what needs to happen is, and I tell people right now, because these prosecutors, we got 350 judges, federal judges, that need to be removed, that need to step down. And what I always like to say, they need to step down, lose their law license, and become Uber drivers. making them Cooper scoopers is not good enough.
Nice.
Making them Walmart greeters is not good enough, because even Walmart complained about this, as written briefs about. Even the American Medical Association, and you know, Jay, how conservative they are, have come out and been forceful about this targeting of physicians using guidelines that simply are not scientific, and we've put all this in our blog. That has made a difference, but it has helped in exposing the deception that is taking place here.
It's definitely approaching the issue to audience members that otherwise would not be aware of this, and it's conveying the message in a manner that's very unique and I feel effective for the patient populations that it needs to reach to. So before we conclude, can you let the audience know how they can get to You're Within the Norms?
Well, simply, all you type out is YOUAR within the norms.com, and You Are Within the Norms will appear. And it will tell you, and you can pick in. There's a lot of articles in there. I thought we would solve this thing in 30 articles. Instead, we've got 215 and counting different articles. But what I can tell the audience is one of the things that you have to do is, one, you've got to get Congress, your congressperson, to say you've got to do something about this. This is affecting the health care delivery of people who in this country. I'll give you an example. I know you want me to conclude, but look at the COVID crisis. Okay, look at the COVID pandemic. Two things to observe there. One is that COVID is an epidemic. So if there was an opioid epidemic, how many beds would then be filled, are being filled right now by opioid patients? No. Very, 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 very little. So you notice this as a whole. The other thing is it prevents you from getting proper health care. When you knock off your doctor, knock off these young doctors who are treating people as we speak, not just for pain, but for every other type of medical condition. But when you knock the condition there is, when you knock off those doctors early, that population that you think they're being treated remain untreated.
That's true.
And so what happens is
those are the core issues. Now, I appreciate that, Norm. Unfortunately, we will have to conclude at this time because of the time limit. But
yes,
thank you so much for your passion. It clearly conveyed through your voice. Your website is very hard-hitting editorials on key opioid and opioid epidemic-related issues. I would suggest anyone who is interested in the topics related to the opioid crisis in general to please visit You're Within the Norms. It is read by a wide audience of both patients and healthcare professionals, and it provides a unique perspective that needs to be read. So, Norm. Okay, thank you so much, Norm. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Jay.
Okay, take care.
Have a good day.